And we're back to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And by the way, you can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM. And we're on the web, Taylor-Report.com. And I believe we are joined now by Dr. Charles Taku. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, Dr. Taku, thank you very, very much for joining us. You have contributed an essay to a really an important new book. It's called Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. And if anybody's qualified to talk about all these things, you are, because you have been, you've represented clients at the International Criminal Court and at the Tribunal for Sierra Leone, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And, of course, you've also published a book, Contextual Foundations of International Criminal Jurisprudence. Now, just to begin with this first thing, the title of the book itself is The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. If that's the case, how did they come to be unbalanced? This is a UN creation. All these bodies that we spoke of here are international bodies. Well, how did they get unbalanced?
Well, it is unbalanced essentially because by our participation in international criminal trials and our experience over a period of 15 years or more, we came to realize that international criminal justice is politicized. Mm-hmm. In other words, international criminal justice has become a political tool for control of smaller states, weaker states, by the superpowers and stronger states. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we came to understand that the statutes of the respective international criminal tribunals and courts did not anticipate acquittals, that people will be acquitted. And that's why mm-hmm. there is no provision in any of the statutes, either the Special Court of Sierra Leone, the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, or any other international court, there is no provision for acquittal. The result being that at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, acquitted persons have not been relocated. Next, international criminal trials became also a tool for victors' justice. At the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, we observed that the tribunal did not adequately prepare a regime for people convicted at the court to serve their sentences consistent with international standards. In other words, the standards set by the United Nations. And therefore, these individuals have been there without adequate medical supplies, no mechanism for them to get their cases reviewed, and we thought that there was a fundamental injustice. And third, we also observed that the international criminal trials have also been used as a tool for regime change. For example, look at the case of Libya. Immediately, Gaddafi was killed. No further action had been taken to bring justice to the many victims of the NATO bombings. We also discovered that the international criminal trials established. Only for the weak, the vanquished, and not the victors, in sort of victors' justice. We were very frustrated by this. We thought that it was necessary for us to write this book so mm-hmm. as to call on the international community that we should go back to the founding principles of the United Nations Charter, which recommended or pledged that there should be justice. No, the justice should not be selective. There should be no discrimination in the administration of international justice, and that there should be equal access to justice, equal rights before the court by all people without distinction as to race, whether big or small nations, from big or small nations, or on any other discriminatory basis whatsoever. I think that was the motivation by which we brought us to write this book.
This is Dr. Charles Taku. The book is Justice Belied, The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice, which has just recently been published. Picking up on that point, we should congratulate you and your client. You defended Mr. Zawanami. I think it was the trial, what's called the Military 2, and you won his acquittal. So you have a direct experience with this, and also, I assume, a very deep concern because he has not been able to leave the town of Arusha.
Yeah, I have a great concern about him. He was detained. He had justice after more than 14 years in detention.
14 years?
Yes, of detention. At the tribunal, at the United Nations Detention Center, he was arrested. He was acquitted, yet he's not free. And Zawanami is not alone in this. There are a number of other Rwandese that were acquitted. Some have been there for over 10 years in the acquittal, and they've not been relocated to a country of choice. Now, one of the reasons I found out is this. The extraordinary propaganda carried out by the Rwandan government at the Security Council United Nations International Forum has made it difficult for countries that may be willing to accept my client and other acquitted persons to take them in. Rwanda became a member of the Security Council almost 2 years ago and has used that platform to attempt to delegitimize the judgments in which my client and others were acquitted, and I conducted extraordinary propaganda. Secondly, the international community, in particular the Security Council, has been unwilling to use its power in order to carry out certain amendments of the statute that recognizes the right of acquitted persons. Thirdly, and I have a lot of fear about this, there have been a conspiracy to send the client Zawanami and other acquitted persons back to Rwanda. And this is a regime that has shown extraordinary hostility towards acquitted persons. They show extraordinary hostility towards even the conflict. And indeed, they have carried out a campaign against the president of the court, Judge Mayron, when the appeal chamber acquitted the client on the 11th of February 2014. They represented Rwanda to Security Council, use that platform to carry out a campaign of blackmail and aspersion against the judges of the appeal chamber, the ICT error. Leaving me to ask this question, that if Rwanda, that purports with the support of the international community to have the capacity to render justice, that the judiciary of Rwanda has the capacity to render justice to people whose cases have been referred to Rwanda, if they can come right to the Security Council and carry a campaign of blackmail against the ICTR appeal judges for acquitting my client and other persons, how much more Rwandese judge? Is it possible that a judge sitting in Rwanda can render justice and acquit if the evidence points to acquittal in the light of this posturing and this campaign of blackmail that the Rwanda is carrying right at the platform of the Security Council in New York? That is the problem.
And by the way, this is quite immediate, isn't it, this issue, because the tribunal itself is about to dissolve into thin air. There are 11 individuals in Arusha in what is called a safe house, strange term, but they sit there, and with no forwarding address. As you point out, there is a campaign against them. These are innocent people, for the most part, and others who've served their time. But it is a shock that we could have. How could you start a process and not allow for the possibility that people who are presumed innocent, as I understand the system works, presumed innocent, might not turn out to be innocent.
You're quite right when you point out that it is the greatest scandal of international criminal justice for the United States and the Security Council and other state parties at the ICC to establish international courts without the provision of the statute guaranteeing the right of accused persons. That is a scandal.
Mm-hmm.
We have in the statute of ICTR Article 20 that talks about the guarantees of minimum fair trials that are found in Article 14 of the International Convention for Civil and Political Rights. But there's no mechanism to enforce these guarantees in the statute of the court.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it has now become a matter of a discretion for the Security Council to decide that discretion to relocate this individual or not. Now, what is even more scandalous is this. In the light of this campaign of blackmail and intimidation against judges who acquitted this individual, the Security Council and the ICTR, they have now proposed that this individual can be sent back to Rwanda or even to Uganda, countries from which witnesses and other Rwandans have been kidnapped to Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, the question that we now ask is this. What was really the relevance of establishing the ICTR? Was it to do justice to the victims of the crime of betrayal in Rwanda? Justice for the innocent, that includes the presumption of innocence. Justice for acquitted persons, justice to the international community. Or was it merely an attempt to share its own responsibility for the calamity that took place in Rwanda, and also to use the trial process at the ICTR to legitimize the RPF regime in Rwanda? Because as long as the ICTR lasted, the RPF used that mechanism in order to blackmail potential opponents
mm-hmm.
of the Rwandans that they could be indicted. And now they are using the mechanism to blackmail acquitted persons, persons who have served their sentences, to blackmail that the possibility of sending them to Rwanda. Most at the same time, the Rwanda is kind of out this campaign from the tribune, from the platform, the Security Council, against judges who acquitted this individual. I think it makes international justice, criminal justice, a mockery, and indeed, it shows that the underpinning for the establishment of this court was more political than to do justice.
Mm-hmm.
The question we also ask is this. How can this trailing of the jurisprudence and the processes lead, contribute to a fight against impunity that it doesn't happen again, when the very court that we establish does not guarantee presumption of innocence, does not protect the right of acquitted persons? How can dictatorial regimes and regimes, murderous regimes in the African continent mm-hmm. that have been perpetrating these crimes and killing people in their millions, how can they believe in the international rule of law when acquitted persons are not guaranteed any right, when there's no provision in the court established by the nation that protecting the right of acquitted persons, whereas this court did not foresee that people could be acquitted and that the acquittal of individuals had become, was an afterthought, and that the court, the Security Council, are struggling to handle this matter. What example are they setting for the rest of the world? What example are they pointing to people, perpetrators of crimes in Africa? What example are they setting to what I can call merchants of impunity who abound on the African continent? I'm afraid that the example of this court, the ICTR and other courts, including the International Criminal Court, are setting for the Africa is that the rule of force, the impunity, or the rule of force or impunity is the order of the day, because the international justice has failed to show that, comprehensively, that people can go through this process with all the guarantees that are found in the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, Article 14, and actually walk free to prove their innocence.
Yeah, apparently innocence doesn't help these. It's just a very tragic situation. You know, when we hear about these things, 14 years in prison and now acquitted but not able to go home, one almost wonders, why does the court itself have impunity from some type of action and all those justices who seem to be so comfortable with holding people for 14 years, finding them not guilty, and then just leaving them to dangle. Unfortunately, we have a political instrument called the Security Council, which it doesn't give anybody any basis to take any action to get justice.
Apparently, now it's now very, very clear that the Security Council established this court without an effective mechanism in place to exercise oversight over the works of the court. The media relied on the reports given by the prosecutors and the judges, really are self-saving, because it's unacceptable that people could be kept for 14 years, he's acquitted, and yet he has nowhere to go.
And no compensation.
No compensation. It is not for want of resources. I think the Security Council is able to lead by example by compensating these individuals and take firmer action so that member states could take these individuals so that they can be nearer, they can go to countries where they will be nearer to their families. I have two cases. There was the case of one Rutaganda. He was defended by one of my distinguished colleagues, David Jacobs. When he was convicted, Sweden accepted to take him for him to serve his sentence in Sweden. The court refused, the ICTR refused, that he should be kept in Africa. Africans should serve the sentence in Africa, which I find, again, unacceptable. But finally, he died in detention. Without appropriate, because due to lack of appropriate medical care. I also have Laurent Semenza, whom I defended, the first guy I defended. Sweden accepted to take him in, applied, papers because he was nearer his family, and finally, no action was taken, he was sent to Mali. Now he's complaining that he's not having adequate medical attention. Now the question is, what was the purpose for refusing those countries who were willing to accept these individuals, only to take them to those countries from which they cannot have access to appropriate medical care? Now, the question of accept in Sweden was important because the laws, the internal laws of Sweden, had appropriate mechanism for commutation of sentence, appropriate mechanism, judicial mechanism for early release, which was not applicable to some of the countries in which they were sent, and therefore they were denied. Even when Sweden accepted the possibility of serving their sentences in other areas, in other countries, where their colleagues in the former Yugoslavia had the benefit of early release, had better medical care, had were imprisoned under the standard, UN standard, but their colleagues from the ICTR were denied this possibility. I think this was selective, this was discriminatory, and again, it set a bad precedent for international criminal justice.
Yeah, no, it is, and I want to ask you about one. You may suggest rightly that there's a behind this is great power politics, in particular the old imperial. I've always been curious. How could it be that the United States itself says it none of these laws apply to the United States, and that they, for example, are not a signatory to the International Criminal Court? And but meanwhile, after showing no respect, basically, for international law because they say they're above it, someone like David Crane, a U.S. Government official for 30 years and worked in U.S. Army intelligence, he ends up the prosecutor in Sierra Leone. And then at the ICTR, we have Barbara Hollis. I think she's associated with the U.S. military. There, certainly others were. And then, and also at Sierra Leone, you have Sir Desmond De Silva, British-American. How do they get these plum jobs of prosecuting Africans?
Well, I will never know. I was in Sierra Leone. I was counsel for the Revolutionary United Front for Sierra Leone. And I went back again for the contempt proceedings. And I was fairly Sierra Leone and also in ICTR and the ICC. And I can never tell exactly what was the motivation behind this appointment. And that the problem about the question of the politics of the United States towards international criminal trials lies in the fact that the policy is ambivalent. We cooperate, but we do not cooperate. And that's where the problem lies. I happen to be the lawyer for Dr. De Masanga, a former Sky News consultant who was in Kenya during the post-election violence. And he was investigated for over a year about allegations of a witness tampering by the order Article 70 of the Rome Statute. And immediately, I found that there were other areas of interference in international criminal investigations and prosecution, which were unprecedented, using the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, and special interests, that they were now gathering information and providing information to the Office of the Prosecutor. I was very, very concerned that the conduct of some superpowers and the conduct of some prosecutors that relying on these NGOs, special interests, in order to get information and evidence of which the prosecuted particular individuals seriously compromise the integrity of the courts, the integrity of the proceedings, and also compromise the entire judicial process. In the case of Kenya, it was very, very unprecedented in that. It led to a balancing act in Kenya, which we all know. Mm-hmm. And most of those NGOs, the people involved in those NGOs, most of them from the finance, from individuals and institutions from the United States and other countries, most of these people now were participants in elections. Some are senators, some are members of parliament in Kenya today. And indirectly, by the participation of these NGOs and special interests, they politicize the process and they skew the process towards serving political objectives and interfering with internal affairs of different countries. In other words, the notion of sovereignty, which was at the basis of the UN Charter, is now completely compromised through these methods of investigation and interferences. Now, with regard to the case of, we talk about individuals getting prom jobs, sincerely, I have not investigated since. Do not know about how they came about, but what I can say is that I was in the trial processes and I was always surprised and alarmed by the unprecedented intervention and interferences by international NGOs with finance from very dubious sources. And it was through these NGOs, which are now a conduit of interfering in African affairs. This is a process. Now, let me cite again the case of Kenya. Mm-hmm. In the case of Kenya, the prosecutors were not concerned that these NGOs in the Rift Valley, these NGOs in Kenya, that they're publishing information about the witnesses, about the trial process, indicating who is a witness. The prosecutor never went after them because they provided information in the first place. Mm-hmm. But individuals, journalists, who are just doing their work as journalists, and who are supported in conducting investigative journalism, the prosecutor went after them. So this was clear. This leads to questioning. In the case of Sierra Leone, I was also alarmed when I got the indictment in the ROUF, the Revolutionary Front, and I saw the way the prosecutor at the time, David Crane, laid out this indictment, especially the supporting material. He made several allegations against like the president of Burkina Faso, Kampaore. He made certain allegations against him for his participation in the crimes in Liberia and Sierra Leone, but also his implication in the killing of Thomas Sankara. Mm-hmm. I think that should be my brain, if I have not forgotten, this paragraph 11 of the supporting material, paragraph 36 of the supporting material to the indictment of the Revolutionary Leader from Sierra Leone. And now, the case that went to the court, the evidence that was in the court, was completely different from the allegations that were made in the indictment and the allegations that were found in the supporting material. And what surprised me was the ability of the judges to to accommodate these changes, these mutations. Mm-hmm. In other words, in most of the cases, the accused person, the indictment, the final indictment, to bring people to trial. But the evidence that actually presented at trial is completely, in most cases, radically different from the evidence they used in order to convince the judges to confirm the indictment. And I found that a bit strange, and I found that the motivation behind some of these indictments could have been political.
Mm-hmm. Just the last minute we have, I do take heart from reading your essay that Uhuru Kenyatta seemed to have woken up Africa about the importance of fair play. Are you hopeful that the African Union will now resist sort of ICC politics?
Well, the ICC politicized the trials in Kenya and elsewhere. Ocampo chose the media. He litigated the case on the media for years. Maligned and ridiculed African leaders. It was not Uhuru Kenyatta who did that. It was African leader who did that. It was the venue of choice by the ICC to litigate these cases. Secondly, the cases, the ICC, the case has collapsed because of poor case management. It is not because witness interfering with witnesses as alleged. And I can say this very clearly. In all the cases I've had, witness protection was the key motivation for the defense and the prosecution and case management. And mm-hmm. secondly, they were not sensitive to the African culture and traditions by some of the statements and the truth they lay. I believe the African leaders and the African Union, the ICC has to work to improve the relationship with African Union. But apart from that, I think the African Union is going to proceed to continue to resist the stickling of Africa, African cultures, African traditions, completely ridiculing the criminalizing and making African as guinea pigs of international criminal law. I think the African Union and most Africans will continue to resist until the ICC can find a formula to make the international justice more credible, international prosecution more credible, and to stop selective justice, and at least to actually cooperate with African Union in order to fight impunity and to fight against international criminality, which I concede actually abound in Africa, so we'll address.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Charles Taku, we thank you very much, and it's a great book, Justice Belied. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. You're most welcome.
Yeah. Bye-bye. And you're listening to Taylor Port, CIUT, and you have been listening. I want to thank Andy at Philconlon. You write to us, taylor@ciut.com. And we'll see you next week.
Want to learn from